Welcome to another edition of BARTcast, a podcast series curated by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. Learn more at bcm-net.org.
Welcome to BARTcast number 26. It is November 27th, 2018, and we are here in the world headquarters of Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. This is Ched Myers, and I am with my partner,
Elaine Enns.
And we are here to have a conversation with Joshua Grace. And here's the deal. A lot of our work, those of you who are familiar with our Bartimaeus Institute online courses know that one of our themes that we often touch on in our work is what my teacher Jim McLennan called biography as theology. That is, seeing the way in which people embody gospel faith in their lives and in their journeys. So we love to interview people about their journeys. And today we have the great and fun privilege of sitting with the one and only Joshua Grace. Say hello, Josh.
Hello, Josh.
What a wag.
You walked right into it, my man.
Joshua helped us cut our first and possibly only hit single today. And we've been having a lot of fun with him. And so we want to talk with Josh. Josh is known throughout our extended community, known and loved around North America and beyond, as a pastor, as a friend, as a serious and sincere disciple of the way. And we're just delighted that he wanted to sit down with us for a few minutes here and do a podcast. So, Elaine, I'm going to invite you to kick it off.
Awesome. Well, the first question that came for us was wanting to ask you about how your growing up experience shaped you. So, what was it like to grow up Polish in a predominantly Polish neighborhood? So, what, you know, in terms of ethnicity and location, how did that shape you?
It was great. Some of my earliest memories are on the east side of Buffalo, where I had one older brother at the time, and my parents, we lived next door to my grandparents in a split home with my uncle and aunt and their kids. They eventually had four. So it was extended family on the block. That was the neighborhood where my great-grandparents had migrated to, the same parish. The central terminal is like a 8 to 10 story train. It used to be for commuter trains. It was like a train terminal. That was our front yard, and it had been vacant since the early 70s. Mm. So then the years after, our Polish neighborhood, you know, was never all Polish. Right. But my youngest, when I was there, a lot of people were moving out, and crack was moving in. Mm. So we were part of the group that moved out. But yeah, those earliest memories were about community, extended, you know, kinship.
Yeah.
And just having a healthy sense of, you know, being Polish is just kind of what we are. You know, the food. I lost some of the language, but my grandmother, my nanny, was a hairdresser, and had a little studio in her off her kitchen. So the panis would come over and talk Polish to us, and you know, watch us when we were outside. We knew that. We were never alone, and also there were always eyes on us. So it would be somebody like, "Oh, I know your grandmother. What are you doing out there?" I remember your dad when he was just a little kid. So that was a lot of security and intergenerational life.
How many generations in the neighborhood?
I would have been the fourth.
Wow. And what's the migration story there?
Poland, around the earliest ones were 1896 till 1915, basically. So some of them technically came from Germany, some of them technically Russia. I think one of them was even Prussia, but it was a lot of, you know, wartime, trying to get out. And a lot of folks came through New York to either, you know, Buffalo, Chicago is the where there's more, even more Polish than Buffalo.
And did you say, did you grow up, as you were growing up, did you learn some of the Polish language, or when you were little, like you were fluent in it?
I was never fluent in it or anywhere close to that. But yeah, little phrases or greetings and going to the Broadway market, you know, to get the fresh food and stuff. You had to be able to have a little, couple little phrases. But I think it kind of died out when my dad and his brothers, when they finished eighth grade, most of that, their early instruction was Polish, but then they went to public high schools and they were kind of encouraged to blend in to, you know, they didn't have the language to say, hey, if you can partake of white skin privilege, now's your chance.
Right.
But go out there and be normal.
Be normal, fit in,
yeah,
blend in.
Melt into the melting pot of whiteness.
Mm. And would most everyone have been Catholic, and was the church very central to the community?
Absolutely. Yeah, being Polish and being Catholic is kind of the same thing back then. And St. Stanislaus was the first Polish Catholic parish in the U.S. and named after the martyr who and the saint back in Poland. So it was a center for community, not just, you know, baptisms and christenings, all that stuff, but also bingo. Yeah, the social hall was active. It's always packed with events. Mm-hmm. I've actually booked an event or two there myself as an adult going back.
Really?
Yeah, it's all family stuff, you know, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
Would you describe yourself and or your family as devout, or what church-wise, what of that do you think stuck with you?
Well, for me, I found out that I was baptized Catholic in secret. My mother learned at my wedding, and then I learned when I was probably 35, that when my parents were sick, they had a hepatitis from a contaminated water fountain. We lived with our grandparents, you know, my brother and I, for 6 months. And then just in case my parents died, you know, my nanny was making sure baptized
taking
us.
Care of them. Mm.
But
and so she baptized you, but she never told your
parents. Never told. I think my dad would have got mad. Because he left the Catholic faith in high school, and then my parents got married pretty young. They were 20. And then when they were like 23, 24, they had a religious experience at Halloween with some Pentecostals. So they became some hardcore holy rollers. And there's a lot of Pentecostals, and there's kind of like an anti-Catholic thing.
Yeah,
and back in the 80s especially.
Yeah.
So for me, growing up was way more Pentecostal. So the ecstatic worship, I still kind of like that people can get pumped up together through some music or some holy trance music, you know, some ceremonial goodness, repetition, and the power of the Holy Spirit, you know, being tangible, being accessible. I like that too.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of, I know your last name that you were born with because your brother Johnny.
Yeah.
Came to the Institute. Say it.
Sheshniak. Yeah, we said Sesniak. That's kind of our Americanized version.
Yeah.
Sheshniak.
There's a city in northern Poland, Sheshen, where that's, is some that people say that's where they, well, it's possible. Also, it means in Polish something like a fortunate person or a lucky fellow.
Okay, so we're going to jump around a little bit, but where I go right away is that when you and Martha got married, you made a big decision to choose a different name. And we want to hear about your faith journey and how, you know, growing up in the Catholic Church, the highlights, the inspiration, the calls. But I also want to hear that bit. How did your name change? I'd love to hear that story.
Yeah, Martha and I, We also got together young, and I was 23 when we got married. Mm-hmm. So and for Martha, she had grown up Catholic, but she's Italian and German. But growing up Catholic, she sort of fell away for a few years, had a faith resurgence when she had gotten pregnant with Helena.
Mm-hmm.
And we got married when Helena was a year and a half. And we were trying to think of ways that her name, Martha's birth name was Fasnacht, donut, or, you know, is the main thing.
That's German for...
Was it Fast Night, First Night, Fat Tuesday is Fasnacht Day. And Fasnacht. Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Dutch.
Yes.
It's a big holiday. So Helena was born, Helena Grace Fasnacht. Mm-hmm. So when we were getting married, we're trying to find a way both to all three of us have the same name.
Yeah.
And then she had a pretty radical conversion to the way of Jesus, finding community and finding some spiritual resources that she didn't even know she was hungry for. So we were really into this grace thing of just this undeserved love of God and how that can form you. So we went with grace. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of paperwork. And back then it was all, you know, kind of hard to navigate. It took us like 6 months to, you know, file with all these, the legal newspaper and see if the FBI would let us do it. But they did.
And what was your family's reaction?
They were supportive. There's actually my grandfather had seven brothers, and four of them changed their last name.
Oh, wow.
So even, Sesniak, kind of, some people say that's not even our ancestor's real name, but that when he came over, either they gave it to him or he lied because he was, the story is that he was wanted by the Germans as a horse thief. But that's my cousin. I think that's more his story.
Awesome.
Can you fill in a little bit more about your own journey to faith? You've talked a little bit about Martha and her conversion at Helena's birth. How about for you? How did you, what were the major stages of your journey to faith, would you say?
Yeah, second grade was my high point of spiritual vitality, and where especially the Pentecostal life really just clicked. And I think by the time I was 13, 14, I kind of flunked out. And I don't know, it seemed like the Sunday thing was getting more contrived. And it was, I sensed that people were trying to appear holy to like follow the rules or not get in trouble or something. And to me, in my teenage angst, I wanted people who were going to be honest about all their problems all the time, which... Now that, you know, I'm older, I'm like, actually, don't be honest about all your problems. All the time. But as a teen, that was important to me. So I kind of went looking in other places for...
So you left the Pentecostal church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then right before I moved to Philadelphia for college, I had this spiritual encounter at a rather large rally at a hockey stadium that my mom asked me to go with and hear this Colombian dude preach in Spanish. But I had this wild just sense of, to go get prayed for. So on one hand, so this is a little bit about what it was like sometimes. Down there in those days, we'll just say people praying in tongues and doing all this stuff, shaking you in the head. People are falling over, being slain in the spirit left and right. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. People love it. But for me, I didn't like seeing people trying to fit in. I thought they were trying to fit in by falling over, or I didn't like how these spiritual men were like pushing people over. So I prayed. I was like, God, I believe in the power of this stuff, but if you want me to fall over, then use spiritual power. I'm not falling over because this dude is like rattling my skull, you know? And they prayed, and they prayed real hard and shook me real hard and everything. And I wanted to feel this power, you know, of the Holy Spirit in that kind of tangible way. And I didn't, and they moved along, and I looked around, and there's about 10,000 bodies on the floor. there's at least a couple hundred on the floor of this hockey arena. And I was the lone one standing. So I was like, well, either they're going to tell me, you know, I got to go to the next line where I got a demon. So I got to do a lot more prayer. But they let me go. Yeah. So then I moved to Philly thinking I was moving to a party school to really, you know, get out of the small town that we had moved to and back into the city. And I ended up kind of being really sincerely looking for Jesus and looking for community and looking for a sense of like, who can we do this with? And I was fortunate to find a church in the first couple months. And that was Circle of Hope. I've been part of that for Circle of Hope for 20 plus years. And those folks were, they had the sincerity thing I was looking for. Then they were talking about like racial reconciliation and justice, even in like how you use your money. And that kind of blew me away. I never really thought of those things before. International peace work. They're Anabaptists. I had only met you know, one family of Mennonites before in my life. So that was, a lot of it was pretty new. So I've been rooted in that, you know, place and people and tradition.
So I didn't realize you'd made it to Circle of Hope when you were in college. So what about your call to ministry? Because you've just completed 15 years as pastor of Circle of Hope in Philly. So how'd you get there? What was your call to ministry? And then what were some of the favorite things that were a part or that happened under your leadership?
Being part of the church for maybe 6 years, I was leading some music. And it's a cell church, so the circles of 10. Mm-hmm. I led cells. And we had this idea that with, like, when a healthy cell is a certain size, it multiplies. So that could work for congregations too. So rather than doing elaborate pastoral searches or trying to hire professional clergy, we wanted to try raising somebody up. Nice. So we formed this apprentice pastor group that met for close to a year, discerning each other's gifts and thinking through, like, hey, what ideas do you actually have? So by the end of that, I had found a friend found a building in Fishtown, which is a neighborhood in Philadelphia, and we wanted to start this MCC thrift store to benefit the Mennonite Central Committee. And I talked to about 30 of my friends and just said, like, hey, I know I'm 24, but if I were the pastor of this new outfit, would you come and do this with me? Would you plant this church? And they were like, yeah, that'd be cool. Mm. So I went back to that group with, here's the good building that, you know, we can get for $50,000, which is, you know, pretty cheap even back then. Mm-hmm. And we could do the thrift store there, the congregation. But I was like, oh, as far as calling, I don't know. Hmm. You know, it kind of feels like I want the Pentecostal thing maybe, but I want this clear confirmation. I want this thunderous message to be like a holy and anointed person or something to do something that grandiose. But instead, the group kind of rolled their eyes and like, oh, you don't have a calling, but like you have all the everything, you know? Okay. So they, the eye roll wasn't a mean one, but it was it's like, of course, you know, it was very confirming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then got to do that, learning about renovating buildings and project management and then small business startup. And then at that point, I'd only ever given two sermons. So most of my pastoral training was not, you know, sermons. And that was really formative for me because I realized the emphasis, the overemphasis on sermons. Sometimes that pastors especially put, there's so much more to the work, to providing this, I don't know, I think it's almost like this positive parental energy where people can feel safe and secure, know that they're loved, know that they belong, know that they have people in their corner. So that was really fun. And then we got to do so many cool projects that were just place-based, very specific. So some of my favorites were like around urban farming, because Philadelphia doesn't have ready access in most neighborhoods to healthy food, especially fresh fruits and vegetables. So taking, you know, going into spaces that are lots that are full of trash and full of, blighted areas, and having them be a place of regenerative life, you know, felt like practicing resurrection. So one of those gardens is still going 15 years later, even though it's, you know, continues to be threatened as the land becomes more valuable. Experimenting with, the thrift store, and that's Martha, my partner, is really the brains behind that operation. And now there's three MCC thrift stores.
That's awesome.
And the amount of friends that we've made through, say, somebody who had to do community service that, you know, had to do, one friend had to do, I think, like 2,000 hours of volunteer work. And by the end, she was indispensable. So we hired her. And then the longer you work there, the more you get paid. So she's like the highest paid person there and only works like 8 hours a week. And she's my neighbor. She lives two blocks down, and now her whole family and her grandkids and her several of her sons. And being able to relationally root in has been just such a joy to that neighborhood, to that particular part of Philadelphia. And just one more little memory is when we baptism, super important to the Anabaptist folks, right? Adult baptism, mm-hmm. the believer's baptism. In the last few years, we started doing them at least once a year in the Delaware River, which is really, it's the main, we're in the Delaware River watershed. It's about less than a mile from my house. It's from where we worship. And it's polluted. You know, the signs where you can't eat fish from it. When you get a heavy rain, the way our stormwater works right now is the heavy rains, our stormwater system can't help hold it. So then the rainwater and the sewage go right to the river.
Right.
So it's not the health of the river has not been central to the plan of Philadelphia and Jersey and all this. So when folks were even willing to get into the water, that was a huge statement of even love of place and humility to place as a teacher. But it was also, for some folks, they would say, I don't want to go in the Delaware River. That's dirty.
Gross,
And I think really, if the river is too dirty to be baptized in, then what is our discipleship? What is that, the question that it raises for us? Mm-hmm. And taking care of the river seriously, even if it's only a means so that we could do baptisms there. Yeah. I think that's a Christian responsibility.
Well, we're about halfway through our interview, friends, and I want to let you know that this podcast is also a fundraiser for Joshua Grace, not for BCM. Joshua is visiting. He's about halfway through the first part of his sabbatical. He's been traveling around U.S. and Mexico. He's here on the West Coast and will be soon leaving to head back on the northern route back home to Philadelphia. And he's in a period of discernment, having left Circle of Hope and looking now to shape what will be next in his vocation. At the end of this podcast, we're going to give you an opportunity to donate to that, what he calls his pivot sabbatical. So please stay on to the end and listen to how you can support this brother in his good work. Josh, say a little bit about how your vocation has been shaped by your family and by your neighborhood, both of which you're very close to.
Yeah. My family is, Martha and then our two daughters are both high schoolers now, which is super cool. Mm. And then my mother lives less than two blocks away. My two younger brothers live in Philadelphia. Martha is from 20 minutes away in South Jersey. Her parents live there still, several of her siblings. We have 16 nieces and nephews around. So the family and the place is very much opportunities for multi-generational connection and enjoying each other. And, everyone loves each other and gets along, and we find social ways to do it. And as far as place, the watershed is a glorious one. It's spectacular. It's the most spectacular place on earth for about 2 weeks in the autumn when the leaves change all throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey. It's just magnificent. And to fall in love with the place was kind of easy in terms of recreation and that, but to live in a city, especially in a post-industrial neighborhood, to me, like, it's been important to care for the creation that I'm on. So we have a little bit of a yard, so I tend to plants there. We grow food and herbs and flowers and stuff for pollinators, and I try to touch it every day. We don't have wide open vistas very close by, but we have shared park systems. So I try to go to a shared park every day to just get in there and share in the green, and then also leave town every month to just go somewhere and be away from light pollution and the noise. We have the sound of the L that we can hear constantly by our house because we're right by it. And those rhythms, learning how to, how to eat, especially like what are the native species and what have people been eating there for a long time, is one kind of way. But then also the rhythms of the year, we get the seasons in full force. Mm-hmm. So kind of enjoying these different moments are those meta, yeah, those meta metaphors are always for contemplation and for even leading different actions, along with like what plants are blooming or, you know, what moon it is, that kind of stuff.
I remember being at your house. Well, you fed us out of your garden. We had cucumbers, we had tomatoes, we had all sorts of yumminess when we were there last time.
It was really nice. I'm really glad you got to be there.
Well, and Joshua is a heck of a cook too. So if you can get to his house and have a few meals, pretty awesome.
Yeah, we'd love to. I love eating. What can I say?
Yeah. Chad mentioned that we just cut our first single with the support of Joshua. And Joshua is an amazing musician that leads the house band at the Bartimaeus Kinsler Institute every year, and just curates such an incredible music space, inviting folks in knowing how to help people shine and supporting the expression of music, which is just such a gift that we are so grateful for. And we had that experience today, and it was really, really fun. But we would love to hear about how music has been a part of your life, you know, in the early years. Maybe we can hear a few stories about Psalters, how that all started, and then how it continues to shape what you do, what you're called to do, the passion, obviously.
Well, first off, people should look at the Bartimaeus Facebook page to see this, the debut single of Three Blind Barts. And yeah, music is so integral to me in sense of practice, or even it evokes certain feelings very easily, you know, and to whether it's certain intervals just bring me to tears. Certain little passages in multiple genres, you know, give me goosebumps. The way that harmonies work together just profoundly inspires me.
Mm-hmm. Has it always been like that since you were a kid?
No, I kind of listened to, I think, some questionable music when I was a kid. I liked it, but I didn't really know that I could do it.
Yeah.
Because in sixth grade was my first instrument. Started playing saxophone.
Oh, nice.
And now when I finally got to barry sax, that's when I knew I was really onto something. The barry sax is just, I still think it's, I love the instrument. I can't. If anybody has one laying around and they want to send me, it's great, but they're cost prohibitive to play. But that got me, and then I got into drums, and playing drums and the rhythm element, I think, is still pretty much the way my brain works. So in large ensembles, so when we, the early days of Psalters, I kind of think the, you know, 96 is when Scotty kind of got it going, in a very sort of like college dorm basement kind of vibe, with people who were sort of outsider musicians, you know. It was all, everybody's first band, and they didn't really know that much, but they were profoundly inspired and had these ideas that were just so great about trying to sort of go the way of the old temple musicians, and then have this justice, this crying out for justice. And people responded to it in surprising ways, even though I think it was pretty sloppy. And we had, you know, 10 people on stage and dancers and people banging on drums and several people who just, you know, sang and yelled around and stuff. And that got a little more refined over the years, thankfully. And I got to do a number of things in the project. And I think rather than being, I think electric guitar is probably like my primary instrument. But if I had to make money, I would be a drummer, you know. And with Psalters, it was a great opportunity to be connective tissue. So even towards the end of our run, you know, in 2011, my brother Johnny and I were the multi-instrumentalists who every song we had to like switch into a different instrument. So like, you know, on a guitar one song, on a drum one song, on a different drum, go play bass. And that kind of that mania is very, very exciting, very stimulating, trying to think, you know, compositionally, even how to like know the song in different kinds of ways. and lately it's been, we at Circle of Hope, we do write a lot of original, you know, worship music, ceremonial music, mm-hmm. and are specifically influenced by a lot of different traditions, especially folks that we have connections to mm-hmm. in the African diaspora or indigenous folks, and both ceremonial music and folk music from around mm-hmm. the world. So we did a couple of albums there. I served more as a producer role, to trying to get other people to be able to hone their gifts as songwriters. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've never been much of a lyricist or even songwriter, but I'm a pretty good collaborator, and that I like being mm-hmm. that soft tissue that helps other people be able to come into their fullness and be able to let them shine a bit, but also like let their vision come into a better reality because it got refined. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like at the Institute, it's so much fun. And we even try to do songs that are easy to sing along with the first time you hear them.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's a particular, almost a genre of mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. But bringing in kind of like the inclusive, hey, you want to be part of the band, let's do it.
Yeah.
That's pretty thrilling. And we've been very fortunate too that so many of the folks who gathered aren't trying to just center their own ego or trying to get their record contract that day, you know, but they're there. We're all participants. We're all part of this community, and all of this music is for the community. It's for this, our formation.
And yet you attract some really fine musicians. Yeah. And so Elaine and I both remember as a high point of the last Institute when Rose Berger suggested a fairly obscure old gospel tune and just kind of shoved it at you. And in very short order, you all had the most soulful performance and participative performance.
Yeah.
Say a little bit about that song and about Sonny Mandrake and the Black Mustard Seed Bomb Squad.
Yeah. Mm. Rose really, if you ever want to talk about music with just a very intelligent listener and curator, Rose Berger is a encyclopedia. And awesome. She found this version of the old Ship of Zion by the Mighty Wonders, who were like a day laborer band in Maryland. Mm. When they recorded that song, I think it was, I don't remember the year. I don't want to even say it because I'll say it wrong. But when they recorded it, they were the only, I mean, this song, the old Ship of Zion, has been recorded, I think, over 2,000 times that most people know of. And they were the only version to have the verse, "There's nothing but love in God's water." Mm. And that just, accentuated what we were doing in the Institute, what we were doing that liturgical day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was amazing. So she sent it to me ahead of time. I had heard it and practiced it. I felt pretty good about it. And didn't have time to teach it to the band, really. So I played it off my phone. We got through about 30 seconds of it, and I was like, "You kind of got the gist." And they're looking at me like, "What?"
And then let's go.
Yeah, I know.
Showtime.
And then we went and did it. And these folks, they were just so good that they picked up where it was. They didn't, try to do too much. And then 2 minutes later, it's like they've been singing this song their whole lives.
Soulful.
Yeah.
Soulful.
It was profound.
Really powerful.
Mm. What are you excited about musically right now?
For me, it's been DJing, and that has been even cool traveling. Like when I was in Mexico, I had a gig at a club in Querétaro, which was really fun. But the last couple of years, my love of hip hop has kind of been stirred again. And I was in these situations. Mm-hmm. So the Carnival de Resistance, we have this bike powered sound system. So various sort of neighborhood things, people who know us hit us up and they say, "Hey," especially if they're like an eco kind of group, an urban farm or some simple way or something like that. So, we set it, and I'm one of the few people that know how to set it up. So I set it up, and then there was going to be a DJ that came and he was late. So they asked me to just play a playlist or something.
Wow.
So putting together a little playlist on my phone is fine, but I was longing for something more. And that happened at 2 or 3 block parties in North Philly or in Kensington, where, I even have okay taste, but and then I saw some of these DJs with their consoles working, what they're doing, and it made it really, it looked super fun, but it also like didn't look that hard. It didn't look like playing the fiddle or something, you know, when you kind of see someone and you're like, oh yeah, I probably can't do that. But yeah, so I got into that. So doing hip hop, and now I think when I was in Mexico, I got a really good education on new, you know, trapeton and reggaeton and that kind of stuff. And working on mixtapes. The next one I'm working on, all, you know, it centers female MCs who are mostly kind of woke female MCs. Yeah. Wow. And I'm learning some new tricks and stuff. So yeah, so that's cool. That's a lot of fun. Mm. And then dancing. The dancing is what it's about. Really, and to be, I mean, that's what I love about DJing, is to be at a gathering where people really want to dance, and you can feel and respond to them, that to the energy, and knowing when to like kind of go faster, go slower, have breaks, or all that stuff. And that's I'm definitely on a steep learning curve, but it's so much fun.
It's so fun. So you and Snowles maybe have to DJ the dance party at the Institute, yeah, man.
That'd be fun.
That would be fun. Another thing to add to the many things you do at the Institute. Okay, so you were just saying you were in Mexico. Now you're with us. You've traveled across North America, or U.S. You are dipping up to my hometown,
yes.
Saskatoon. You are on this big journey. It's your pivot. What is this all about? What's it mean for you?
Yeah, the vocational pivot is kind of like how do I finish pastoring well and even be part of the community that I pastored, but also refine some of these things that I've been kind of burning inside me that at times kind of stretch the role of pastor, maybe even a little bit too far. Mm. So especially around... I think pastors should be involved in the justice movements pretty heavily, especially around this environmental catastrophe that we're living in, and figuring out how to help people and communities decenter white supremacy. But I think that as I'm about to turn 40, and it's 7 years since my last sabbatical, my oldest kid's about to turn 18, I feel it's coming of age in a new way. Mm. So I'm thinking about what is God even directing me towards in my 40s. So I have some instincts about that, but I have some deeper questions that I'm taking a couple months to answer. And that is an incredible gift that I even have some time to be able to ask long questions and wait and get a lot of input and not have to just kind of functionally have to get a different job or have to already have had an idea while I was in my former role of what I was going to do next. So to me, it feels like a huge gift to have this liminal space that I can play around and enter into and not know where it's going to end. So yeah, by February, I hope to release the first season of a podcast that I'm trying to do as well. And after that, you know, I have a few opportunities already about either with some kind of trainings, partnering with some friends, doing some work around, you know, dismantling and decentering white supremacy. Mm. Probably gonna do some stuff with some young Anabaptist leaders, but I'm pretty open to what that could be. I mean, we're based in Philadelphia, but you know, I love traveling, and I have if I have any gifts, it's my largest gift is that I have an amazing friend network that extends. I mean, throughout. I mean, this trip, a 2 month trip, you know, sometimes I slept outside. There's a few nights that I slept in an Airbnb or something, but I've been staying with friends.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people have stayed at my house too. Mm-hmm. So that's even super awesome. Fun. Yeah, to come back and be like, hey, remember when you said if I ever, you know, if I ever come out your way, here I am.
Here I am. Oh,
you're awesome. You're somewhere in the middle of this sabbatical. So far, so good. Is it finding it renewing? Energizing, inspiring.
So far, it's super stimulating and fun and exciting. And it's kind of the most fun I can remember having. Mm. And some of that also is that my stress level has dropped.
Yeah.
From, and anxiety is just way, way down. So like, yeah, worrying about things like, can I drive 8 hours without falling asleep? That kind of stuff. Some days are the things that you know, are my tangible worries. Of course, it's always, you know, my kid's health or something. I just can stress about that. But yeah, and the people I'm visiting, a lot of them are folks that I've collaborated with in the past on art projects, on music projects, on justice projects, or different kinds of movement spaces. So it's a lot of it is even like, hey, remember, you know, when it's really fun to work together, I used to not have that much time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I got tons of time. What are you thinking? What are you doing? What can we collaborate in? Mm. And eventually I think some of those opportunities are going to help shape answers to questions like, for me, even like, what really gives me life? Mm-hmm. What kind of work makes me alive on the inside to where I'm able to do, live on my best self, my full self. And I know what it's like to do that and be able to, like, even say when I was 24 and we're, you know, renovating buildings, starting businesses, planning churches. And for me, that's just really exciting and not tiring for a while. Mm-hmm. So sort of trying to rediscover a little bit of like, what really gets all my, you know, gets me into sixth gear, because I want to produce, you know, I want to do stuff. Yeah. You know, as much as I love just screwing off and having fun, I mean, you know, I'm really looking for some deep work here, some meaningful work. Mm-hmm. And so who I'm going to work with particularly, or what I'm going to do, I feel very open about that. Mm. Probably will have, you know, for me, I always have the faith component, but working in interfaith spaces or, you know, non-religious spaces, that's totally, I'm totally open to that too. Mm. But yeah, so how to get there, I'm not totally sure. Right. But right now I don't have to know. Right. And that's also the joy of it and the fun of it. It's just
part of the nature of sabbatical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Josh, you do have an incredible network of friends, and you're a great networker and you're a great friend. And your friends love you, as we do. How can listeners help support this sabbatical? You've fashioned this as a little bit of a community-supported sabbatical, as someone who's given your life to building the movement for the last 15 years. How can people give back to you to support this vocational pivot project?
On my blog, I started a new blog not too long ago, joshuagrace.wordpress.com, and there's some writing and stuff and links to some of the different social media stuff I've been doing, but also a little tab about donate. And that's the good people at Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries have sponsored this as a nonprofit so that folks can get tax deductible benefit from their donations. But as I'm trying to do this first trip is, you know, pilgrimage one, I'm trying to do four here in the next 4 months. One of them is extended time in the wilderness, which I love, you know, solo hiking. And I'm trying to just, some of that's in bits, but I'm going to do a chunk too. One of them is extended time with mentors. Mm, so that's when I'll be coming back here even for more time in February and hanging out with the Woodleys, particularly up in Oregon. And then the final one, I'm hoping to go back to my own roots. So go to Poland. I've never been to Poland.
Yeah. Wow.
And to even not knowing who or where exactly to go, but I know that I want to put my feet in the Baltic Sea.
Yeah.
And I want to put my hands to the heavens and see if anything happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
then, so yeah, my blog, you can see those links for how to, you know, do electronically or checks if anybody wants to join me in this journey and help me figure it out and help shape it.
Well, Nani, who secretly baptized you, I think would be very happy for you to get to Poland. So friends, let's help Josh on his vocational pivot. So it's joshuagrace.wordpress.com.
You got it.
You can also just go to the BCM homepage and go to the donate button. That's www.bcm-net.org. And press the donate button and just put in the memo line. This is for Josh Grace's vocational pivot. let's raise some money for this brother so he can keep on his way as he finds his way into the new season of his life. Josh, thanks for visiting us. Thanks for your friendship over the years. And congratulations on completing well a very fine piece of ministry work. And we pray for great grace and renewal and clarity as it emerges on this sabbatical journey of yours. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and we love you and are so grateful for your friendship. Thank you.
Amen. All right, friends, support the sabbatical. JoshuaGrace.wordpress.com, bcm-net.org. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to the BartCast, produced by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. To find our resources or to donate to support the BartCast, please go to chedmyers.org. Thank you for listening.